are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of sociology at UC Davis and author of Leftism Reinvented, Western Parties from Socialism to Neoliberalism, Professor Stephanie Mudge will be joining us. Meanwhile, Democrats to issue subpoenas in the wake of the White House security whistleblower revelations. Then while they're at it, tomorrow they'll vote on sending William Barr a subpoena for the Mueller report. Meanwhile, Trump punts on Republican magic care for all until after the 2020 elections. And Neil Gorsuch leads the way for the Supreme Court ruling that cruel and unusual punishment in the forms of painful executions A-OK. As the moon wades its way through Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, Department of Homeland Security assures us that white extremist terror groups, no bigs, as it disbands the Domestic Terrorist Intelligence Unit.
Disbanded.
Trump attacks Puerto Rico.
The pajama boy is over.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump attacks Puerto Rico because why not? And today, big election in Wisconsin for the state Supreme Court. Get out and vote if you are in Wisconsin. Super important. Meanwhile, fundraising numbers released. Bernie crushes it.
Do, 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 do. Go screw yourself.
All this and more on today's program. We were just playing Joe Jackson in the pre-show. If you listen to the audio podcast, you can hear the music that we play, but we can't put it on the video because it gets us dinged. And then it becomes a real problem. But back in the day, when I was in high school, if you saw that someone had like Look Sharp or I'm the Man in their record collection, maybe even Jump and Jive, then you knew they were cool. That's basically it. Mostly Look Sharp and I'm the Man, but nevertheless, that was basically.
You knew they were a hip cat.
Total.
Do you see?
Total hip cat.
Because then they knew.
You would see the album. You'd just be like, groovy, man.
Oh, my God. Do you have a magic eight ball?
Totally.
It's so cool.
It spins around, and every time it's a different answer. So the fundraising numbers were released today and end of the quarter. Nothing as big as Barack Obama in Q1 of 2007, but different constraints, obviously more candidates running this time around with a greater ability to fundraise. So the pie may be a little bit bigger, but there's a lot more people who are saddling up to cut the pie and eat it. So, but the big... And have we heard Beto's fundraising numbers yet?
No.
We'll
I don't
wait
know
to
the
see.
Totals of his yet.
But Kamala Harris announced yesterday that she raised $12 million from more than 218,000 individual contributions in the first quarter of 2019. Somebody can do the math as to what each donation would amount to. Harris, of course, had raised $1.5 million in the first 24 hours, and then Bernie and then Beto ended up crushing those numbers. I guess 98% of Harris's donations were under $100.
That's, really? That's interesting.
Well, that's also like a weird... That's a, it sounds odd. You got to dig into that a little
bit. I want to see those numbers divided by parents arrested for truancy.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, and look... This stuff gets overblown. Like, there were 900,000 contributions made to Bernie by 500 and something like 20,000 people. The average donation was $20, but you've got people basically who made two contributions, you know, 450,000 of those people, more or less. 400,000 made two contributions, which pushes down the average number of contributions and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, look, people know the broad contours of this story. And so, you know, people can get caught up in this. 500,000 people, though, is a lot of people to donate to a campaign. 20% of those are new from, I guess, from last year. I mean, excuse me, last go-through. So he's picking up people. There are obviously... Still, I think 2 million people donated to Bernie at one point or another last year. So there's still, you know, and at 1.5 million people extant, can't anticipate that all of them will choose Bernie again this time because they were choosing him because he was one of two choices, really, last time. So who knows? But the bottom line is Bernie got big numbers. People are waiting to see what Beto's numbers are. And the real import of this ultimately will be how long will candidates stay in the race? How long will they be able to afford to stay in the race? You know, these numbers in some ways have more importance to a Harris or a Beto because they've got to make a case to big, big donors in the primaries. And Bernie obviously won't be doing that. And so the numbers that that Harris and Beto do at this point, and Warren just you know, said goodbye to her finance chair because she will not go after big donations. And I think he probably is like, well, I can't do my job then. I need to go. I work on a commission. And so I need to go somewhere else. But for those people who are going to ultimately need more money from big donors 3 to 6 months from now, what they get now has a lot of relevance. So, you know, Bernie's going to be in the race until the end, folks. And that's clear here. And it does not appear that he's going to be raising so much money that it's going to scare other people out of the race. I don't know that that could have ever happened. So, you know, I don't know. At one point, like, box office numbers became like the most important thing in the world. And these fundraising numbers are important, but they have, you know, you got to put them in context as to what they actually mean. And Bernie's going to have plenty of money to raise to run the race that he wants to run. And it's just a question of how much money are the other candidates that are, you know, in many respects trying to be the anti-Bernie or the non-Bernie candidate. So we shall see. But here is Bernie Sanders. And he was at the
We the People?
Yeah, the We the People town hall. This was yesterday. And Bernie basically explains that this policy of so-called right to work, in other words, which fundamentally kneecaps unions and really prevents workers from their right to organize in many respects. Yeah, he's done with that.
Legislation that we've introduced says that in America, workers have the constitutional right to organize. That's called freedom of assembly. And therefore, in that legislation, we outlaw the ability of states to pass and maintain right-to-work legislation.
There you go.
That's hell excellent. Yeah. That is really, that's clear.
That's especially important because we're kind of close to getting federal right-to-work right now, right? Or as I like to call it, right-to-work for less.
I mean, on some
level. Or as I like to call it, right-to-work for less.
I mean, on some Bernie level, I think we have a version of that that came from the Supreme Court. I mean, this is going to be. I mean, this is part of the problem is that and there is we're going to see, and I'm already seeing this like on the antitrust level, more and more written about the technical assessing whether this stuff can actually be done without a broad-based legislative, support, because judges are going to shoot down a lot of this stuff. And those are all, I think, valid points, but second-order points. You need to first have a political leadership that has the will to do these things and the intention to do these things. And then they need to make the argument. Not only must they appoint judges and whatnot, but then they need to make the argument that it requires more legislation than we have currently. And so to a large extent, I've read these articles. I may talk about them, but in the final analysis, it's a second order issue at this point. They're perfectly valid arguments. But from a political standpoint, they're largely irrelevant because the prescription to deal with this stuff is basically the same. You need to elect people to office who have the will and the policy to do these things.
And don't forget, also, he's going to need a ton of grassroots support for all this legislation, like
yes.
Megan Day said the other day, in order to get anything done, this movement's going to have to keep going.
It's going to have to expand and get more intense. And perhaps, you know, we're so far away from even seeing the contours of what things are going to look like in the general election. And who knows, you know, what happens if someone like Bernie gets into the general election. In terms of what it does for the grassroots. But before we get there, today the Majority Report is being supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app. It provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations.
That sounds great for you, Sam.
It does. Well, I was going to say for you. I feel like you got your guided meditation wardrobe
loaded
on.
Game. Oh, God.
It's sort of. We can go into that breath. More specific. But as you know, there's a lot of evidence of the benefits of meditating. It's a stressful world, folks. And the benefits go beyond just dealing with stress. Building mental acuity. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They have guided meditations for mindfulness, mediation meditations for anxiety, for depression, for when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination or for when you have something important going on at work, meditations designed for parents because children are difficult. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break. Your children are difficult. When you've gotten home from work, when you're going to bed. I am getting closer and closer to starting a meditation regime. I've dipped in a little
All
bit.
All of the children are yelling, lavender is in your eye. We're going to let go of that.
The thing that makes it easy is this, right? Like for me, it's always about the bar to entry. And Simple Habit drops the bar to entry. Different people are trying to accomplish different things with meditation. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation or how much past experience they've had with meditation. The variety of guided meditations Simple Habit is what sets it apart. Simple Habit just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available for iOS, Android, and on a web browser. And the Majority Report audience can try it for free for a week. Go to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube or listening to the podcast, we put it in the show description, simplehabit.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to professor of sociology at UC Davis, Stephanie Mudge, about leftism reinvented. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, author of Leftism Reinvented, Western Parties from Socialism to Neoliberalism. Stephanie Mudge, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So your book essentially outlines three, I guess, eras of leftism as seen through the prism of four different parties, left parties in the United States, the Democratic Party, and then three different ones in Europe. Just tell us just broadly about the broad contours of what you're looking at in terms of which parties and really going back until the late 1800s.
Right. Well, the four parties, as you said, one of them is the American Democratic Party, which is sort of a outlier in some respects. The other three parties are the British Labour Party in the United Kingdom, the German and Swedish Social Democratic Parties. So I pick out those parties for different historical reasons. They're all sort of very influential in their own way. The German Social Democratic Party is sort of the original mass party of a sort of socialist Marxist left. And the German and Swedish Social Democratic Parties were also very tightly, well, the Labour Parties also, of course, were very tightly connected to labor movements. In some cases, were drivers of the national sort of national level organization of labor movements. And so in the early part of the time span the book covers, those parties are really the focal point because they are drivers of what I call socialist leftism. Where they speak a language of that is very familiar to anyone who's read the Communist Manifesto. They read it and they speak a very explicitly sort of Marxian socialist language. And then the Democratic Party isn't really part of the analysis at that point because it doesn't speak that language and has never been a socialist party or a sort of arm of the political arm of the labor movement. So then the scope of the book kind of follows a transformation, especially in those three parties, those three Western European parties between the turn of the 20th century and the sort of around the 1930s, 1940s, the timing varies a little bit, where they start speaking a language that sounds a lot more like the language of an academic economist, specifically a Keynesian economist. So they start speaking in terms of wages and prices and full employment and controlling government through budgetary devices and fiscal policy. And by that time, the Democratic Party, especially in the New Deal period, starts speaking in a very similar language. So one of the arguments of the book is that there's sort of a convergence in the ways that center-left parties in Western European countries speak and the way the American Democratic Party speaks that kind of comes together, especially in the wartime and interwar periods. And then the final transition that then all four parties are a part of or express in some way is between the mid-20th century, sort of 1950s, 1960s, which is the peak period of what I call Keynesian or economistic leftism, and the 1990s, which is the point at which all of the parties I deal with start speaking in a different language, which is what I call neoliberalized leftism. And the hallmarks of that is a sort of trilogy of emphases on markets, strategy, and sort of market-conforming policies.
Okay, so let's go back and dig in specifically because I'm sort of fascinated because on some level Elizabeth Warren, who's running for office now, is associated with this idea, or I don't think it's her idea, but she's in many respects is like sort of executed along these lines of personnel as policy, and on some level that is the essence of what happened as you track these various parties in terms of their the way that they were reinvented in some respects, and then ultimately it almost like takes us to AOC in some respects. And maybe that's just because these are the things that I'm covering on a daily basis, so it gets I'm a little bit myopic in that way. But let's go back to that first era,
mm-hmm.
And then we'll work our way up. Just talk about the personnel, if you will, or the so-called experts at that time when we start off as these parties are socialist and this is in Europe. Give us a sense of like what's happening in the U.S. that tradition is not. Is not engaged. I mean, once we get into this, what you call the economic leftism, or Keynesianism, there's a convergence. Mm-hmm. But where was the Democratic Party or the U.S. left at that time? The Democratic Party, A, and B, let's talk about like those actors who were providing the socialism for the European parties?
Right. There was a very active socialist party in the 1900s and 1910s, especially in the United States. And it was actually increasingly powerful and increasingly influential. It held a large number of seats. It was led especially by Eugene Debs, who was actually a pretty successful presidential candidate, I think the year was maybe 1912 that he pulled the most votes. So there was, and that was linked to, it was a workers' movement, and it was linked to what was then a very strong labor movement in the United States. was capable of calling general strikes and other sorts of things. So that was going on, but it was really separate and really in opposition to either both of the major parties. And it's important to remember the Democratic Party at that time was not actually it was sort of associated especially with politics of the South, had a strong Southern contingent. It was not strongly associated with the progressive movement, was sort of politics based on expertise and knowledge and analysis, and sort of deliberative progressive projects. That was more associated especially with originally with the Republican Party and with its break off the Progressive Party, and was headed by Teddy Roosevelt. So the Democratic Party wasn't really, it was sort of a big tent. It was especially grounded in the South and a sort of racial politics, and wasn't associated especially with progressive politics and certainly not socialist politics. But it had progressive elements. And so what I focus on, the thing that happens inside the Democratic Party, and this has to do with the way the party is organized. Unlike European parties, the American parties can't really police their boundaries in the same way. They're not sort of organized, bureaucratic, hierarchical entities that can police their ranks. And so the story that I tell especially is about the 1932 campaign of FDR and how figures inside his campaign pull academics into the famous Brain Trust, who are mostly lawyers, but there are a few economists. They're centered especially at Columbia University in New York, and how that becomes a basis once that campaign is successful and FDR moves into the White House, how the sort of experts and academics that he brings in with them become sort of recruiters of other kinds of academics and experts, especially economists, who drives the formulation of what becomes New Deal economic policy. And it's in that process that Keynesianism or Keynesian economics, which had been really marginalized, well, remember Keynes' famous book, The General Theory of Interest of Unemployment, of Employment, Interest, and Money, comes out in 1936. By that time, the New Deal administration is already in place. There are already economists who are, some of them are sort of institutionalists. Some of them are become sort of Keynesian after Keynesianism becomes a thing. But that's really marginalized from the academy. But because they're already located in the federal government, they already have access to political power, they're able to kind of formulate Keynesian-type policies and legitimate and mainstream Keynesian economic thinking. And it's from there, actually, that Keynesian economics, that Keynesian economists become, it's after that that they're able to kind of become more prominent in the academy, places like Harvard and MIT.
So, I mean, it's sort of counterintuitive as to, rather than this Keynesianism being adopted by the administration, on some level, it makes it.
Yeah, in some ways, the argument that I make in the book is they kind of constitute each other. So FDR kind of builds. I mean, he had a very eclectic administration in some way. There were lots of different kinds of people, and it was a very experimental administration. They were trying all kinds of different programs to deal with a massive problem of unemployment and political unrest. The argument I make is they sort of constitute each other. So, and one thing that's happening also inside the economics profession, which we have to remember is a very different profession than much smaller, among other things.
Well,
but one of the things that's happening that may be familiar now is that there are younger economists who are frustrated with their professors, who are frustrated with professors especially who are telling them that essentially nothing can be done on a policy level about the problem of unemployment. And they sort of defect or are chased out of the academy and find a home in the New Deal administration.
I want to make sure, though, that that you also touch on, you know, what was happening in Europe insofar as, like, so that the idea that, because I think now it's almost impossible for people who have a casual relationship with politics, or even a more a less casual one, to conceive of the idea that bringing in so-called experts from academia or economists was not, you know, was a, that was not necessarily the way that things worked, right? Like
no, not at all.
And I think this is important because there is a, we now just assume, at least the conventional wisdom in our politics, is that, well, this is an economic argument. As opposed to it being a political argument, I think part of that is because of the, you know, you touch on the context of the book is that it just so happens that these people were brought in, and there was a perfectly functioning political, you know, way of doing politics without a so-called expert in the economy, supposedly.
Right. Yeah. Expert in the sense of specifically sort of credentialed academics, you know, with sort of formal training in economics. It is one of the most striking things if you look especially to the European context. In all of the European cases, what I show for the Labour Party and the Social Democratic parties that I analyze in the book is that their key, remember, these are working class movements. These are not and so the sort of rank and file of these parties are not highly educated people at all. And even the leadership, relatively speaking, compared to leadership of the older, more established parties, I'm thinking especially of the UK here, they don't have elite academic credentials. And so the so-called sort of experts that they have, the people they bring in who have expertise on matters of budget and economic policy are journalists and public lecturers. And they have no particular training in economics, which in the British case at that point isn't even really you can't really get a specialized credential in economics at that time. That's something Keynes himself, John Maynard Keynes himself, had I think exactly something like one quarter or one semester's training in economics. He was trained in statistics. And this was true of the other countries I study as well, that the sort of key economic experts are not economists as we would think of them now. They're people who have a great deal of knowledge, and they have a great deal of ability to speak and appeal, especially to working class constituencies. But they're journalists. In the German case, they're more sort of highly educated, but the key economic expert in the German Social Democratic Party in the 1920s was a man named Rudolf Hilferding, who was trained as a physician. So they're essentially, in those cases, they become economic experts by virtue of working for newspapers, journalists, weeklies, working in editorial capacities and as journalists that are, and all of those outlets are associated, they're either sort of directly funded by social democratic parties or left parties, or they're affiliated in some way. But they're not, it's true, they're not academics at all. They have very little, if any, academic training.
So when we get into this next era, where in the United States, Keynesians are recruited, and then in some respects, the FDR's administration essentially elevates Keynesian, and I guess it's sort of like a feedback loop on some level. How does that change? In some respects, in terms of the Democratic Party, it makes there seems to have been a vacuum in some respects. Because so many things were being sort of thrown against the wall, there was a lot of opportunity there for one, contingent, I guess, to emerge. How did that happen in Europe?
Well, I try to trace out processes on two sides. One is that the social democratic parties, I'll just say left parties, it's easier, are becoming viable parties of government in the early 1900s. And as they, and what I mean by that is, as opposed to having sort of one or two people who are able to hold office, they have more office holders and it becomes possible for them to enter into coalitions or to even become governing parties. As that happens, they start worrying about, the leadership starts worrying about kind of recruiting the next generation of leadership. And for instance, in the British case, they set up clubs and summer camps and things like that in the Oxbridge campuses, for instance, so that you can kind of, they basically create channels for entry into the party, especially through sort of universities and university-educated circles, in order to recruit the next generation of leadership. And the next generation is then, they're sort of connected to working class politics. They're socialized into working class politics through the parties, but they're also academically trained. And there's a particular interest because of the problems at the time, problems of finance and unemployment and taxation and budgetary management and problems of radical inequality, which are not that different from now. They're interested for all those reasons and economic expertise, people with economic training. And especially with a capacity for statistical analysis. One of the things that people with economic training can do is they can provide statistics on things that they thought were problems but weren't necessarily sure what the scale of the problems were. So on unemployment, for instance, it was disputed in the 1920s exactly how big the problem was and what the sources were of the problem and, you know, therefore whether or anything could be done about it. So part of it is that the parties start sort of becoming more formal organizations, larger organizations, more powerful political presence, and they start recruiting or kind of, you know, pulling in, trying to draw in leadership. Part of it is just, especially in the British case, the problem of wartime economic management. This is especially in the British case, the government itself becomes a recruiting site for people with economic expertise because it's required for wartime planning. So that's what's happening on that side. On the other side, it's really in the period between the 1920s and, say, the 1950s that economics becomes a sort of full-fledged, autonomous academic discipline. One that is relatively consensual in the sense that the methodological orientations become more consensual, and Keynesianism or sort of Keynesian style of thinking becomes a sort of orthodoxy. There's kind of these changes going on both sides. And one of the reasons that economics becomes sort of consolidates as a prestigious profession in that time is because of its political influence. It's because economists are being drawn into government and into political parties. And so there's sort of a two sides going on,
right?
Which is that, you know, of sort of politics and political parties becoming more dependent on economics, and economics sort of consolidating, growing, being more demand. There being more demand for training and for economics training and economics degrees, and growing in prestige because of its growing public influence.
So that era essentially lasts until the 1970s, early 70s, when the party experts, as you call them, now having gone from journalists and sort of other public intellectuals who are shaping the policies of these various parties to the extent that, you know, we can include the Democrats in that. Maybe less so, but certainly in terms of Europe, and people should understand it. It's also the idea of bringing certain lived experience of the working class into these parties gives way to the Keynesians. And then in 1970 or so, the party experts shift again to what you call, well, I can't pronounce it, TFIS.
I know. Transnationalized finance-oriented economists.
Yeah, I feel like you should have had like some like I in there so I could call it like TIF or something. But TFE, transnational finance oriented economists. They are you don't necessarily call them neoliberals, but they have a neoliberal almost, I guess, worldview. What's the distinction and what does that mean?
Well, what I'm trying to avoid there is this sort of explanation by name-calling, especially in the European context in the 1980s and 1990s. To call somebody on the left in the Labour Party or Social Democratic Party a neoliberal was to call them Thatcher, you know, was to accuse them of selling out. and becoming and sort of adopting the positions of figures like Reagan and Thatcher. So there was a politics to it that I was trying to avoid. What I was trying to, nonetheless, it's true that in the 1980s and 1990s and all the cases that I look at, you start getting figures in all of these parties who see the world in what you might call a neoliberal way, in the sense of seeing the world in terms of markets as forces out there, sort of beyond the reach of governments, beyond the reach of politics, beyond the reach of humans, to manipulate or control for any particular purpose or end, say full employment or raising wages or whatever. And so the worldview that you find is a world where there's kind of markets out there, and what politicians can do is only adapt to what markets require and try to work sort of with them in order to benefit from the growth and that markets bring.
So this is basically just an idea of markets being a force of nature, and
exactly
our comporting. I mean, this is where the big change happens on some level too, right? Because it's like our comporting to to gravity, to physics.
Exactly.
And instead of us being able to go and build a building that is shaped a certain way, we have to build it in a way that it doesn't fall because gravity exists and physics exists, and we can't control that. And it changes, it really has a fundamental change in the way that we perceive politics too, right?
Yes, exactly. So what I try to trace in each case is first of all, that this is this sort of neoliberal ethic, this way of seeing things as a transformation centered in economics, especially by the 1980s, 1990s, American economics really lies at the center, is highly influential of a much larger, much more globalized or internationalized profession. And so this sort of neoliberal ethic, I focus especially on economists at the University of Chicago, many of whom are sort of, insofar as they're political, they're Republican or right-leaning, but because they're influential in the profession, and because they offer a sort of definitive explanation of the crises of inflation and unemployment in the 1970s, they sort of change the orthodoxies of the profession. What I argue is that they sort of kill Keynesian ethics. So as opposed to neoliberal ethics, where the idea is politicians are helpless in the face of the market, and the only thing economists and politics should do is tell politicians how to adapt to markets. The Keynesian ethic was a more sort of, was more oriented toward discretion and strategic trade-offs, as in the economist's job is to do their analysis, bring it into politics, and then present politicians with different possibilities. You know, if you do X, this will be the consequence for inflation or unemployment, or if you do Y, you can do this. But to be sensitive to the necessities of people who are representing, who are elected representatives, who are representing constituencies.
I just want to tease this out just in terms of like, so with Keynesian economics, it starts with what you're, it's explicit about about starting with what your agenda is, as opposed to finding the world as it is. And right. Like, so it's like you can, I mean, can you just tease that out a little bit? Because I can, you know, the neoliberal worldview that, you know, really we're just trying to figure out the truth that exists out there in nature, these markets. And you can either comport to them or not. And if you don't, you're going to get crushed. Whereas Keynesian has more of a room to say, like, okay, this is your agenda. This is how you would achieve it. But more explicitly saying, like, you're making a choice of what you want, right? I mean, how explicit is
right.
that?
I think it was pretty explicit. I wouldn't say. So my argument here isn't that economists were kind of explicitly adapting their analysis to politics, but Keynesian economic analysis, the core of it, at the heart of it, was an understanding that there was a trade-off between unemployment and inflation. You could have more of one or more of the other, but not both, which is why other economists argued that Keynesianism was dead in the 1970s, because you had both. But in that way of seeing things, then the trade-off actually came back after the 1970s, let me just say that. But that way of seeing things, if you think about it, the people who are worried about inflation are people who have money. It's finance and
right.
people who have a lot of financial wealth. And the people who are worried about unemployment are working people.
And we should be clear as to why if you have a lot of money, you don't want it to be devalued.
Exactly.
And that's what inflation
exactly.
does. And it also,
exactly.
if you've lent money to people, inflation makes it easier for people to pay you back. Because
right.
their wages are going up. Your interest rates are fixed, theoretically, on the loan that you gave them. And so suddenly they're doing 40 hours a week of work and they're having more dollars because of the inflation. And their payments are fixed, though. So that's
right.
Okay.
Exactly. So the language of Keynesian economics and the sort of basic problematic of Keynesian economics, this sort of idea that there's a trade-off between these two things, is also a language of politics. You know, it's a language of political of the economic interests of different constituencies, in a way. And so that sort of whole mode of analysis allowed, in particular, left parties to deal with the sort of conflict of interest between those constituencies, right? And to think explicitly about how, especially, or to what extent it could or should prioritize its main constituency, which were the wage earners, the working people. But, you know, if they're in government, you also have to deal with withholders of money, you know, with
right.
people who have with banks and finance. So it was sort of a technical analytical language, a mode of analysis that also allowed left parties to govern in a way that was sensitive to the demands of their constituencies. But thinking about the world in terms of markets, the dictates of markets as sort of forces out there, it's a very different mode of analysis. And it doesn't really, the argument that I make is that economists, and I emphasize these are still sort of left-leaning in the U.S. democratic or in the European context, social democratic economists, self-understood Democrats and social Democrats. But if you understand the world in terms of markets as sort of forces out there, then the kinds of prescriptions you give what I argue is that they're sort of proscriptive instead of prescriptive. In other words, it's about what you can't do, right? You can't spend this money. You can't do things that markets, especially financial markets, won't like.
Right, because you're basically trying to just push against like the waves coming into the ocean. That's not
right.
You're not going to get anywhere, and so
right.
And what's interesting is that this for neoliberalism to flourish, it needed essentially to consume the left-leaning parties because. For neoliberalism to flourish, it needs to remove any impediments, and there were none on the right to neoliberalism, right? I mean, that was just simply those impediments being the interests of non-moneyed people.
Well, I think there were impediments on both sides, to be honest. I think that this sort of move to the embrace of whatever makes markets happy, what you see during this time, the rise of neoliberal politics in general, not, you know, on the right and the left, is growing political alienation, disaffection, disidentification from parties in the American context, declining membership in the European context. You see the birth of new far left and green parties. You also see the far right anti-immigrant parties that are now very powerful in Europe and elsewhere emerging during this time. So I think this politics, it had impediments on both sides, but I think that what happened is that constituencies that were sort of alienated or for whom, you know, these politics, it didn't help them, I think they defected from politics. On the left, the really significant thing, I think, is that left parties are supposed to be, in theory anyway, sort of mouthpieces or representatives of poor working class people or people who don't have a great deal of political power. They're supposed to kind of speak for them, in theory. And historically speaking, that's been how they've positioned themselves. And so it's really important when they start sort of embracing a sort of market or neoliberal worldview, it's really important that they, in a way, play a role in trying to persuade those constituencies that they should see, that they should come around to these policies that really don't do them any good. So, for instance, labor market policies or welfare policies, where instead of them having secure pensions or generous unemployment protections, that instead they should give up those kinds of protections, and they should only qualify in the United States for welfare if they're also looking, if they're also participating in the labor market and low-wage jobs, things like that. These are not policies that are popular with people who don't have great job market opportunities or don't have possibility kind of moving up the wage scale. But, you know, it was really left parties that were responsible for trying to sell those kinds of policies as in their interests. And in the long run, I think it's clear now anyway that that didn't work.
And so where are we at least in the context of, you know, let's say the Democratic Party? But I think we could also, you know, obviously I think people are familiar enough with what's going on, at the very least, in the Labour Party in UK. Like, where are we at in this stage? Like, are we on the cusp of another, if you were to write this book 25 years from now, are we at the cusp of sort of reverting back in some way to a or maybe not reverting back, but I guess finding a different era of where the party leaders or apparatchiks, I guess, are some, you know, reoriented?
I think it seems to me that what's happening now is more like the 1920s or 1930s than like the 1960s or 1970s, in the sense that I think is obvious to a lot of people that the workings of the economy or workings of markets aren't really reconcilable with the interests of communities, with sort of meaningful democratic political representation. You know, there's a real concern around, especially in the U.S., of course, about money and politics and the effects of inequality on democratic institutions. So, you know, I think there's a lot of recognition of that inside the Democratic Party. I think it explains the growing popularity of the Democratic Socialists. I think, and Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, people, and Elizabeth Warren especially, because of her very incisive critique of the workings of finance. I think that it's very similar, the kind of fractures you see now inside the Democratic Party. It's in a way, it's sort of like the 1920s when there was a fracture between both of the mainstream parties and the Socialist Party. The difference, I mean, there's also a huge number of differences. The one difference that I would emphasize the most is that the economic world is not at all the same. So, and the thing that is different is the role of finance and the ubiquity of debt, both public debt and private debt. Household level debt is absolutely off the charts. Right. And there was nothing like that in the 1920s and the 1930s. It makes the moment a lot more unstable, in my opinion, now than it was then. And inside the Democratic Party, I also think the world is very different. In the 1920s, there weren't tons of think tanks in Washington, D.C. There weren't political consultants. There weren't, I mean, you know, these kinds of, this world is sort of professional politics that we see now didn't exist then. It was a much smaller world. It was also a much less diverse world then. It was a world where politics was dominated by white men. And by immigrants from Europe also. So those things are very different. But in terms of the sort of depth of the fracture and people making a new connection between, or making connections between the sort of dysfunctions of the democratic process and dysfunctions in the economic world are very similar. where that's going to go, you know, I would love to say with any certainty that it's all going to get worked out. I'm a little worried that that it gets worked out only after some series of new crises. Mm. You know.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah, I hope that that's not the case. I do have a great deal of hope right now for what's happening, sort of the broad progressive ranks inside and outside the Democratic Party right now.
Indeed. Leftism reinvented, Western parties from socialism to neoliberalism. Stephanie Mudge, we will put a link to your book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, you can support this show by becoming a member. And when you do, you support the daily free half of the show. And then we give you extra content every day. Every day. Bonus content as a way of saying thank you for supporting the work we do in the free show. I'm looking at Matt queuing up the Bullprog's
Prog is a genius
animation of this of the Fun Half song.
Well,
it's pretty amazing.
So many talented people in our community. It's kind of insane.
Don't forget you can justcoffee.coop this month. You don't need the coupon code majority, and you will get 30% off. This is the month to try all the various Just Coffees you've been thinking about trying to see if you like them at a 30% discount.
Could they plug in the coupon code just so they know that they're coming from us?
Sure. It always helps plug in the coupon code, but you don't need it. But put it in there, but you will get 30% off. You can try all the different types of coffees. Then see which one you like, and then buy a 5-pound bag of that stuff. So we got in here. We're getting down. Well, no, we got it in that container there. But we're almost gone.
There's no more.
There's no more. So check out justcoffee.coop. Also, again, join themajorityreport.com. Today is Tuesday. Michael is here.
Yes.
No emergency room. No doctor's notes, nothing.
This guy's like, you really need that? I was like, oh, definitely.
And what's content. Happening? What's happening tonight?
For the podcast?
Yeah, for the podcast, bro. What is happening tonight is Kim Ives, who is the editor of Haiti Liberté, is going to talk about that the real story behind those American mercenaries that were caught in Port-au-Prince. Several weeks ago, and how that relates to ongoing U.S. interference in Haiti. Then Malaika Jabali is going to join us. We're going to talk about 2020 and Wisconsin, how to make things happen. Then, of course, a post game with a lot of other things from Turkey to Brazil to South Africa. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada. On last Wednesday's, here, I'll put myself on camera. Last Wednesday's episode, we yank-splained Brexit with the help of our friend, Niril Shah. And thanks to the Tories' utter incompetence, it's still very relevant. This situation has not been resolved, in case you were wondering. Then on Friday, we released a bonus episode where we talk to some of our patrons. That was pretty cool. I think our listeners are extremely quality, I must say. And then this week, we're releasing an episode on the Gilets Jaunes uprising in France, which has been ongoing for many months and shows no signs of stopping. So watch out for it.
Matt?
Coming up on Saturday, is Oscar Wilde the first proponent of a fully automated gay luxury space communism? Well, he is maybe for a couple of those things, and probably not the first, but maybe one of the most notable. So look for that.
He was into automation.
Hell yeah.
He was a big machinery guy. Kropotkin was too.
That's
and
fascinating.
Wilde got it, I think, probably from Kropotkin.
The importance
and Morris.
Of being automated.
He's like, man is made for much more than, much better than disturbing dirt, meaning like sweeping up. So
right.
We need machines to do all that stuff.
Hell yeah. We can't have communism if we don't have machines. Just don't make them too smart, and then they'll overthrow you.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.